The Evolve Network is now live at evolvenetwork.tv. Subscribe for meal plans, recipes, cooking shows, and our very own The Magic Pill and The Magic Plant, as well as access to my favourite documentaries. The Evolve Network is also home to our full library of podcasts, with new release podcasts airing first and in full on the channel. You can also watch selected vodcasts in a video format. Enjoy this highlight of our podcast and head over to evolvenetwork.tv for the full Evolve podcast experience. The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informal look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, peteevans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Dr. Jason Fung is a Canadian nephrologist or kidney specialist. He's a world-leading expert on intermittent fasting and low-carb healthy fat, LCHF, especially for treating people with type 2 diabetes, and his books are The Obesity Code as well as The Complete Guide to Fasting. You can find out more on Dr. Jason Fung at idmprogram.com or Intensive Dietary Management Program. He is the author of The Obesity Code as well as The Complete Guide to Fasting. Jason, thank you so much for being on the podcast, and I believe, or I just know, that our listeners are going to get a real thrill out of the information that you're about to share with us today, especially on diabetes and type 2 diabetes, because you talk about this as being an epidemic. Now, explain what an epidemic is and why this is happening at this particular time in human history for us, please, mate.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This is great, Pete. I think that this is a very important health problem. And just to give you a little bit of background, I'm a kidney specialist. So that means that I did my medical training kind of conventionally. I spent another 5 years doing my specialty training in kidney disease. And the most common cause of kidney disease by far is type 2 diabetes. So I started practice about 15 years ago. And we have just been seeing more and more people with kidney disease. And as their kidneys fail, I put them on dialysis and so on, and we would treat them with medications. But it soon became fairly clear that people were not really getting better, despite the fact that I was giving them lots and lots of medications. And it gets to the point where people kind of give up, and this is the real problem. So type 2 diabetes, if you look at what a lot of people say, is considered kind of a chronic and progressive disease. So you hear this all the time. Patients will come in and they'll say, oh, well, I have it for life. There's nothing I can do about it. And the truth is that this is not really true. It's never really been true. And it's very easy to prove. So if you have somebody who is overweight and has type 2 diabetes, if they lose weight, then their diabetes very frequently goes away. So therefore, the disease itself is not a chronic and progressive disease. It's not like aging where you will get older no matter what you do. There's just nothing you can do about it. So therefore, you kind of give up trying to get younger. But type 2 diabetes is not like that. It's a disease, But yes, it can be reversed, but you have to do it in the proper way. And what was very clear was that the conventional treatment of type 2 diabetes was not working. So the diets that we were prescribing were not working. The lifestyle interventions we were prescribing was not working. So then doctors would eventually resort to giving a lot of medications, and those medications were not making people healthier. So what people typically did was that they got diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. They got started on lifestyle treatments, usually a low-fat, calorie-reduced diet, and nobody got better. So then doctors started medications, first one, then two, then three, then four, then insulin, then more insulin. And when you look at it logically, what you see is that if you are taking more and more medications over a period of 10, 15 years, your diabetes is not getting better. It's mm-hmm. only getting worse. So if you think about it, what we have is, let's put these two facts together. One, type 2 diabetes is largely a reversible disease. And number two, almost nobody was getting better. Hmm. Well, when you put those two together, the only thing you can say is that the treatment is completely incorrect. And that's kind of where I started from. So if you kind of go back and say, okay, well, if type 2 diabetes relies on losing weight to reverse it, well, then that's what we need to treat, because that's the root cause of the type 2 diabetes. But that's not what we were doing. We were giving a diet, a low-fat diet, a calorie-reduced diet, that had almost no chance of success for weight loss. And again, this is one of those things where nobody wants to be the bad guy and say, what we're doing is really stupid, this sort of low-fat, calorie-reduced diet. It's really bad. It's like the story, the emperor with the new clothes. Nobody wants to say, you know, the emperor's naked. The thing is that if you look at large databases in the United Kingdom, for example, the probability of going from obese to normal weight or morbidly obese to normal weight is somewhere on the order of 0.2% to 1%. That's your success rate. In other words, we were prescribing a diet that had about a 99 to 99.8% failure rate.
Wow.
That's ridiculous. Mm. And that squares exactly with the clinical experience. That is, everybody's done it and nobody succeeded. So no wonder people were not reversing their type 2 diabetes. They were not losing weight. Then you go to medications, and we were giving people things like insulin, which caused weight gain. So if the reversal of type 2 diabetes depends on losing weight, and the doctor is prescribing a medication that causes weight gain, guess what? Your blood sugars may be better, but your diabetes is only going to get worse. And the thing that's funny is that patients knew this. So I would prescribe insulin, because I did this for many years before I kind of changed.
Yep.
I would give them insulin. They would gain weight, and they'd come back, and they say, whoa, this insulin you gave me, it made me gain 20 pounds. You tell me that I need to lose weight, then you give me a medication that makes me gain 20 pounds. How is that good? And the answer is, it's not good. As they gain weight, their diabetes gets worse, then they need more insulin. As they take more insulin, they gain more weight, which makes their diabetes worse. So they're stuck in a vicious cycle that's only getting worse. So that's when I started really thinking about it. It was around 2008 when really the studies caught up to my kind of nagging doubts about what we were doing. And remember, this is really the core of everything I was doing day in and day out. It's very hard to admit that you studied for like 11 years in school, worked for another 10 years, and realized that, hey, the most of what you do is not very useful and might have been making people worse. It's not very easy to admit that. But that's where the point where I was. So in 2008 was when two very important studies came out in obesity medicine and type 2 diabetes medicine. So in obesity medicine, we started to get the results of a lot of these studies on low carbohydrate diets, which were relatively high in fat.
Yep.
And I, along with lots of other doctors, thought that it was going to be a disaster, this sort of Atkins diet. So the Atkins diet in the late 1990s was all the rage, and doctors like me thought it was going to be killing people left and right. So all of these studies were done with almost the express purpose of proving how bad these diets were.
Yep.
And then something funny happened. People were getting really healthy. Their diabetes was better. Their cholesterols were better. They were losing weight. It was ridiculous. But that's what the evidence showed, that these high-fat diets, these low-carbohydrate high-fat diets, were actually not bad at all. And so that was a real eye-opener for me. And then very shortly after, in 2008, same year, some of the studies on type 2 diabetes were coming out. So just to, again, back up a little bit, type 2 diabetes is characterized by high blood glucose. And for a long time, we thought that it was all about lowering the blood glucose. Mm-hmm. So you should give as much medication as you needed to get that blood glucose down.
Yeah.
And that was the core of what we did in medicine for like 30, 40 years. We taught it to all the medical students. We all believed it. We all practiced it. So a couple of studies came out, the ACCORD study, the ADVANCE study, the VADT study, the ORIGIN study. There's multiple million-dollar multinational randomized controlled trials. And what they showed was that you took two groups. One group you gave a lot of medication to, got their blood sugars really down closer to normal. One group you didn't care so much and didn't give as much medications.
Yep.
So what they showed was that, yes, if you give more medications, the blood glucose got better. But what they also showed was that even when you gave more medications, people were not healthier. That is, they were still having the same heart attacks, still having the same strokes. The first study to come out actually showed that the high medication group actually were dying at a much faster rate.
Wow.
And so it's like, okay, well, here it is. Yeah, it was incredible. It was this, everything that we had been doing in type 2 diabetes had just been proven completely wrong. What we had done in medicine was we had focused so myopically on getting that blood glucose down, and it wasn't making people healthier. They were having the same heart attacks, strokes, kidney disease, everything. So why would you take a medication if it wasn't going to make you healthier? That was the real question. And so it was a complete paradigm shift in type 2 diabetes that we needed to make. But unfortunately, over the next 5 or so, 10 years, nobody really took that next step and say, well, what do we need to do? In fact, we just kept doing exactly the same thing that we used to do, even though we just proved it completely ineffective.
That's what you would call insane, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So that's where kind of things started. So I really started to look at type 2 diabetes and trying to understand what type 2 diabetes is, what insulin resistance actually is, and how we can make people lose weight in order to start reversing their type 2 diabetes. So that's when I started, shortly thereafter, we started our program, the Intentionary Management Program, where we use low-carbohydrate diets and intermittent fasting to really start to get these type 2 diabetics and reverse their disease. And it was funny because as soon as I started, some of the stories were just ridiculous. They're like people were coming in with hundreds of units of insulin and, for 10 years. And in 2-3 months, we'd have them off everything and their blood glucoses were just almost normal. So, 15 years of diabetes, which was reversing in like 3 months sort of thing. It was ridiculous how quick people were getting better. And that's why we started to kind of expand and also to do some of the lectures about type 2 diabetes and obesity. It turns out they're both related diseases. Of too much insulin is essentially the problem. So where we had gone wrong was that we were using a diet that was very stimulating to insulin. That is, low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets raise insulin. If you eat all the time, you stimulate insulin. So the problem, which is too much insulin, we are making it worse. If you do the opposite, if you cut down the carbohydrates, the refined carbohydrates, and you reduce the number of times they eat, then you're going to lower insulin. So if the entire disease is too much insulin, then you need to lower insulin. And that makes sense. What we're doing was we're treating a disease of too much insulin with more insulin and then wondering why it wasn't working. And that's crazy. It's like treating an alcoholic with more alcohol and then wondering, I wonder why his alcoholism doesn't get better. It was the same ridiculous sort of mentality that we had. So we were treating this disease by making it worse. And then saying, well, it's worse because that's just the way it is.
When you explain it like that, it just makes such common sense that I'm just surprised that the medical fraternity have known about this for 10 years, as you said, with those research papers and the studies that came out. But it's still not being picked up by the mainstream medical system. When do you believe that it will?
I think that it is going to take 5 or 10 more years, because the medical community, the research community, has a lot invested in this sort of paradigm. That is, there's a lot of people who have built their careers on doing it this way, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling insulin and selling drugs and so on. It's a multi-billion dollar business, so nobody wants to know about it. That is, if you are a researcher, for example, and you've just spent the last 25 years trying to prove how you need to give more insulin to a disease of too much insulin, or you need to give insulin which makes you gain weight even though the problem is that they're overweight in the first place. If you just spent 25 years, it's very hard for people to say, oh, well, guess what? I'm wrong. It's making it worse. And the same thing with drug companies. They have invested a lot of money into developing new types of insulin. The fact that they don't make people healthier is entirely beside the point. All you need to do is convince the doctors to prescribe it, and these are multi-billion dollar drugs, and that's money. So they've invested a lot in it. So in order for people to change, it's going to be very difficult. But there's a good side to all this. The good side is that we don't need them to take our side. We can start right now by telling people the truth, and people can start using their own diet without their doctor's help, without their dietitian's help, just do it and get healthier. And that's the real power of what you do, Pete, is that you can raise awareness of this, and people can actually start to look into it, and they don't need anybody to do this for them, because the diet is something that they control themselves without interference from anything else.
Well, I have one question for you, doctor, and that is, you say it's a disease that's generally precipitated by being overweight or obese and having a diet that raises the insulin. So how come there's certain people out there that I know that have been athletes, for instance, and they're very lean, they've been training all their lives, and they believe they've had a healthy diet, and they get to 50 or 60 and they develop type 2 diabetes, but they're not overweight per se. So is that because their diet has been wrong? I'm just a little bit confused, and I'm sure a lot of listeners will also know people in this realm.
Yeah, the whole issue is that it's not really just the weight. It's actually the fat inside the organs that is the problem. And sometimes that is not visible. So if you look at, for example, the Chinese population, they develop type 2 diabetes with an average body mass index of 23.7, which is actually completely normal. So 20 to 25 is normal, and it just doesn't look like they have type 2 diabetes. Americans, for example, will develop type 2 diabetes with a body mass index closer to 28, which is on the overweight side, close to obese. So it's not just the overall weight that's important, but actually the fat inside the organs. Probably the most important factor, truthfully, is dietary sugar. So you can't see it because it's all packed away in the liver. So the liver is the main organ to be concerned about. It's the fatty liver which causes a lot of this type 2 diabetes, and it really holds the key to it. And this is the one thing that people have to understand, is that you can exercise all you want, but you can't exercise your liver. You're exercising your muscles, your joints, your tendons are going to improve, but your liver is not going to improve. Yes, you're going to burn some calories doing exercise, but you're not going to get rid of the fat inside that liver. And fructose, which is part of the glucose and is part of the sugar, sucrose, is really the main culprit in that. So you actually see a very close correlation between intake of sugar, for example, and rise of type 2 diabetes. So it's most clear in a place like China, for example, in the 1990s, they had a very high carbohydrate diet. They're eating a lot of white rice. And everybody says, oh, it's brown rice and stuff. That's crap. I mean, I have relatives who lived in the area and they all ate white rice. So they're eating lots of white rice and there's practically no diabetes whatsoever. And the issue is that they ate almost no sugar. So sugar with its fructose, so high fructose corn syrup and table sugar, are much worse than carbohydrates like bread, which is glucose, causing type 2 diabetes, because that fructose kind of goes straight into the liver and causes that fatty liver. So athletes, perversely, are at fairly high risk because they're drinking all this Gatorade, especially the older ones that grew up in that era of Gatorade and Powerade and all those kind of sugary drinks. And they all thought it was fine to drink the sugary beverage and exercise. You're going to burn it all off. But the problem is you're burning off the glucose, the fructose went into your liver, you got fatty liver, and then years later, despite the fact that you're exercising like crazy, you're getting all this type 2 diabetes. In China, what happened is that their sugar intake has been rising very quickly as they sort of westernized their diet. And combined with their original high carbohydrate intake, what's happened is that they've had an explosion of type 2 diabetes. So they went from approximately 1% in 1980 to approximately 11.4%, I think. That's a huge rise.
Huge.
Like a 10 times rise in type 2 diabetes in a single generation. And this is what's scary about the whole thing, is that everything that's happened has happened since about 1980. This whole, if you ever look at old pictures from the 70s and you look at the people on the street, it's shocking because people are so thin. It's ridiculous. And everybody wants to say, well, it's genetics. It's genetics. It's not genetics. In a single generation, the genetic pool has not changed very much. It's time to sort of admit that this is a dietary problem, and what is it that we have changed in our diet that has made us so poor? And that's where we really can educate people and then help them take control of their own health.
Well, let's take a step back then, because I'm getting a little bit confused here, and maybe the listeners are as well. So you're talking about the fructose being the main contributor to fatty liver disease. Now, when I've read your books, which are fantastic, The Obesity Code and also the upcoming one, The Diabetes Code, you talk about limiting the high carbohydrate foods. So, for instance, you just mentioned rice, but in your books you also say it's probably not the best food to be eating, whether it's bread or pasta or rice. Now, how does that work from what you've just said about fructose and fatty liver and insulin? Can you explain that then? And are these foods best to be avoided as part of a management program?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. So if you think about type 2 diabetes, what it is essentially too much sugar in the body. Everybody wants to make it more complicated, but it's not really. So sugar, table sugar, is composed of both glucose and fructose. So glucose is the sugar contained in most carbohydrates, so bread and rice and pasta. If you have table sugar or high fructose corn syrup, which is very similar, you have one glucose and one fructose. The difference between glucose and fructose is that all cells of your body are able to use that glucose. So if you eat a pound of sugar, you get half a pound of glucose and half a pound of fructose. The glucose is used by your entire body. So all the cells, all the muscles, all the liver, all the kidneys, the brain, they all use the glucose and they burn it off. The fructose, though, cannot be used by any cell in the body and heads straight into the liver. So therefore, what happens is that fructose goes straight into the liver, and because you don't need the extra energy because you have all this glucose, it just gets turned into fat, and that's where you get the fatty liver.
Yep.
The fatty liver is really where the kind of diabetes starts. If you want to think about what insulin resistance is, so you hear this term quite a bit, which is insulin resistance. And what it means is that insulin is a normal hormone that when you eat, your insulin tends to go up, and that tells the body that food is coming. So you open up the cells so that they can take on some of this food energy and you use it for energy and you store it and you don't burn your stored energy. So food is coming, insulin is going up, you're storing food energy, your body is using the glucose that's coming in. Insulin resistance refers to the fact that when people eat, their blood glucose, which should stay normal as the glucose goes into the cell, starts to go up. And that's when you check your blood sugar, for example, and if it's high, your doctor tells you you have type 2 diabetes. And the reason they say it's insulin resistance is because if you measure insulin levels, it's not low. It's actually very high. So there's plenty of insulin, but that insulin is not able to force the glucose from your blood into the cells. So that's so-called insulin resistance, and they're essentially synonymous. So type 2 diabetes is insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is type 2 diabetes. They just kind of fall along a spectrum. That is, if you have very mild insulin resistance, you may not qualify as type 2 diabetes, but they're essentially the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, people tried to say, well, what's causing this insulin resistance? And one of the things is that they had this sort of lock and key model where they said, well, there is something that's blocking the insulin from opening up the cells and letting the glucose go inside. That didn't really work out. What it really is a sort of overflow paradigm. That is, if your cells are already jammed full of sugar,
yep.
Now you eat, your insulin goes up, and you're trying to jam more sugar into this already filled cell, it's not going to go in. So it's that's why your insulin resistance, because it's already full. It's not that the insulin isn't working. It's working, but you can't shove it in. So if you want to imagine like a suitcase, when you're putting clothes into an empty suitcase, goes in, no problem. If that suitcase is already full, you can't jam in those last two pairs of pants because it's already full. There's nothing wrong with the pants. There's nothing wrong with the suitcase. It's just full. So that's what causes the insulin resistance. So think of our body as a sugar bowl. So if we start out with the sugar bowl empty, and over time, you put some sugar in, you burn some sugar when you don't eat, and you put it in when you do eat. If you're putting in more sugar than taking out, over time, that bowl fills up. Now, if it's completely filled, the next time you eat, the sugar just spills out into the blood. And what your body does is say, whoa, I see all this sugar that's in the blood. I don't like it. And all this glucose. I'm going to produce more insulin to really shove it in. Okay, so now you're using more force, more insulin, to shove the glucose into a cell that's already filled with glucose. And that's what happens. And it compensates over time. At first, your blood glucose stays normal, but only because you're producing so much insulin. If you think about the suitcase, what's happening is that you're just using a lot of force to jam close that suitcase. Eventually, it comes to the point where the body is completely filled up and it can't take anymore. So then your blood glucose goes up. What does your doctor do? Well, you go to your doctor, he gives you more insulin. Insulin was already high. Insulin was the problem in the first place. So it just keeps shoving in more glucose. And over time, your body just keeps filling up more and more with this sugar. And it goes initially to the liver, but the liver sends it out all over the body. It packages it as fat because the liver has the ability to turn that carbohydrate, the glucose, into fat. It's called de novo lipogenesis. If you have too much glucose, body turns into fat and sends that fat all over the place. So you get fatty liver, you get fatty pancreas, you get fat in the muscles, you get fat around the organs. So you get this abdominal obesity where all the fat is stored around the organs and you get a very high waist size. So what you see is this kind of big beer belly that people notice. Even if the arms are not very fat, you might have this big beer belly. So that's the real problem, is that the bottom line was that there's just too much sugar, not in your blood, but in your whole body. And this is the mistake that we made. We're using drugs like insulin to take the sugar out of the blood and jam it into our bodies. And our bodies didn't want it. Eventually, it took it, but eventually it developed more resistance. So then you had to use higher and higher doses. If you're using higher and higher doses of medications, your diabetes is getting worse, not better. So the answer not to do that, the answer, obviously, if your body has too much of this sugar, is empty the body out of sugar. So when I tell people, I say, well, think about your car. If you have a car and you fill up with gas and your gas tank is full, but you still need to put some more gas in, so you're forced to pump this gas into your back seat. Well, what would you do? What you wouldn't do is go to the gas station 3 times a day and keep pumping this gas into your back seat. You say, that's really stupid. What you need to do is, one, stop putting gas in, and two, drive that car and burn it off. So if you understand that the whole problem is just too much sugar, both glucose and fructose, then one, you cut down the glucose and fructose. So that's why we say cut down the refined carbohydrates, cut down the fructose. And two is you want to burn it off. What we use is intermittent fasting. Everybody thinks that it's exercise, but again, it's the liver that's the problem. It's the liver that's getting too much glucose that's now packaging it as new fat and sending this fat all over the body. So you need to so-called exercise that liver, which is clean it out by not eating. And guess what? It's a completely natural process. There's no drugs involved. There's no surgery involved. You can start doing it tomorrow if you want to, and it's completely free. It's a completely natural solution to this disease that is making us so sick.
I don't mean to laugh, but when you explain it like that with the car and with the sugar bowl and with the suitcase and the most simple explanation and, I guess, protocol to follow is to stop eating for a period of time called intermittent fasting. But here's the thing that I'm sure a lot of people that have type 2 diabetes and other people that might have weight problems or other people that just are addicted to food, they're going, how am I meant to stop eating for 12, 16 hours, possibly even a day, which I've read in your new book, you're advocating that people can basically not eat one day, then eat the next day, then not eat the next day, and so on. So how do people that live their lives craving food implement this? And obviously it's a decision, but does it go a little bit deeper with addictive personalities? How do we give the gift of, you've given the gift of knowledge, but how do we give the gift of putting this into action?
Yeah, that's a great point, because even if you have the knowledge, none of this is easy. Like, it's simple, like the concept is simple, but to actually do it is not that simple, because we all get hungry, we all want to eat cake. It's normal. That's not, you know, a defect. That's just makes us what we are. So there are things that we do need to do. One is sort of provide support for people to do the fasting, to do the low carbohydrate diets. We have to give them good recipes, you know, and make it acceptable, because the thing is that something like intermittent fasting is not well accepted at all. There's a lot of myths surrounding that. And that was one of the things that I tried to address with my second book, which was The Complete Guide to Fasting, was a lot of these myths that fasting is bad for you. You're going to shut down your metabolism. You're going to burn through muscle. A lot of these myths actually are not true. And the truth is that fasting has been used for thousands and thousands of years. And it's been used safely. Every religious group uses it. And it gets couched in different terms, whether it's a purification or a cleansing or a detox. It's the essential idea is that by not eating, you're allowing your body to clean itself out of all the junk that's making it sick, which is all that glucose and all that fat in the liver. And guess what? It actually turns out to be true. So there's a lot that goes into it. So making it socially acceptable, because one of the things that people do when they fast is one of the big mistakes, I think, is they tell their doctor, they tell the dietitian, or they tell their friend, and their friends who is, you know, doesn't know, but is trying to be helpful, says, oh, you can't do that. You should never do that. It's like, okay, well, what? You have a 300-pound person with the most severe type 2 diabetes, and you think they can't miss a single meal? What do you think is going to happen? It's interesting, because when I talk to doctors, and I do give a number of lectures, doctors almost immediately understand that there is nothing wrong with fasting. That is, we tell people to fast all the time. When you go for a colonoscopy, you fast. When you go for surgery, you have to fast. When you go for fasting blood work, you have to fast. And we all know as doctors that when we were doing medical residency, medical school, we fasted all the time, because we were just so busy that you didn't have time to eat. And you just worked right through. That was just the way life was. And nothing bad happened.
Like a chef.
That's right. And if you're busy, you work. That's it. And it's not like you're going to die or something. And if you look around the animal kingdom, for example, you see bears that are going 6 months hibernating, so no food. You see lions that eat once a month and snakes that eat once a month. So you know what? Guess what? That's the reason our body stores fat. is for us to use when there's no food to eat. If you are always eating, why would your body burn off that fat? That's its stored energy. So it's going to hold on to it. What you have to do is give your body the time to burn off that fat that is making us sick. So doctors almost immediately understand that there's actually nothing intrinsically wrong. But you do have to use some common sense. That is, not everybody should fast. That is, pregnant women shouldn't fast, and children shouldn't fast. And if you're malnourished, you shouldn't fast. You know, if you're on medications, you need to get some medical advice as to what to do with those medications, especially for diabetes medicines. If you fast and take the same dose of medication, you could put yourself at real risk. But getting back to the question of what we need to do, we have to make it socially acceptable. We have to put in the support structures that the doctors are there to support patients. We have support groups for that. And this is one of the things that I sort of learned through trial and error over these last few years. So in the last 4 or 5 years, we developed this program called the Intensive Dietary Management Program. The website is idmprogram.com. And what we do is try and provide that support. So we give a counselor who is able to help people with the fasting, because there's not a lot of knowledge about that. We can help them with problems that come up during fasting, because again, it's not fun and it's not easy to stick to. And we do small group sessions, because that peer support is actually very important. In school, of course, we talk about peer pressure. That is, even if the teacher tells you to do one thing, you may not do it if all your friends are doing something else. So it's very important to get the support of your peers to do something. And we want to harness that for the good. So we put people in small groups, and they're all trying to do the same thing. They're all trying to lose weight. They're all trying to get, reverse their type 2 diabetes. So there's great support in that. And groups like Weight Watchers, groups like Alcoholics Anonymous had figured that out a long time ago. It took me a while to figure out, but eventually I realized that the small groups are actually one of the real keys to success for these patients. So you have to have the counselor who knows how to help people, like if headaches come up, if constipation, with diarrhea, you have to have somebody who's done it, who knows what they're doing, who's had it. You have to have the peer support, and you have to have the medical support from your physician. And that's the sort of program that we've tried to put together in this IDM program. And over the last few years, it's been really very rewarding, because it's incredible to talk to people. And this morning I had a group of 4 people, and all 4 of them had virtually entirely reversed their type 2 diabetes. One was on like 45 units of insulin, one was on 180, one was on 95 units of insulin, and all had basically become pre-diabetic or non-diabetic. And it's really incredible to talk to them, because it's the reason that we all went into medicine. We didn't go into medicine to prescribe pills and watch people go on dialysis and get their feet chopped off. We went into medicine because we wanted to make people better. And here I see people in front of me who had reversed their type 2 diabetes, something that their own doctors had told them was impossible. And it's like, wow, that really makes me feel good, and it makes them feel good. So it's great. It's a win-win situation. The government saves money because it's not paying for all these drugs. It's not paying for all these heart attacks, these strokes, this kidney failure. They don't want it anyway. And hey, everything just comes down to applying the right knowledge. I'm not talking about building great surgical centers. I'm just talking about spreading knowledge to the people who need it, and then putting in the support for them to actually do well. So we have a fasting support group, but there are ones online that you can join for free. You can read the books. They're very inexpensive. You can read the blog for free. You can go on to great websites like dietdoctor.com, which has great recipes. There's a UK website which has a free low-carb program called diabetes.co.uk. And, of course, stuff like you do, Pete, which is promote these healthy diets for people to reverse their disease. And it's like, this is amazing that we can do this for people without building great hospitals and incurring huge expenses and so on. It really kind of reinvigorated my sort of passion for medicine.
I really hope you enjoyed the first half of this podcast. If you'd like to listen to the rest, please visit evolvenetwork.tv. That's evolvenetwork.tv. We'll see you there.
The information, Views and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.